This is in regard to Reverend Louis Overstreet, whom I apparently first encountered on a street in the north of Baton Rouge, an area they called Scotlandville. And that was a result of my, I guess, looking for people who might be in touch with blues singers. So I went to the local radio station in Baton Rouge, where a black disc jockey apparently welcomed me, and he actually took me around and took me to that part of town. And because he said, well, if there's any blues happening, it'll be in this area, you see. And I forgot exactly who he was, but apparently I had been listening to him on the radio. And there he was, set up, you know, just like you will see in those pictures, outside of a beer joint, and he was plugged in inside the place. And I was very much impressed by this man because he was absolutely, totally sincere. And, you know, I thought he had a really good voice, and he played an interesting guitar, and he had these four sons of his. It was quite a sight. And who would answer him, you know, would act as kind of the congregation. But I had no idea what I could do with him at that time. You know, I was strictly into blues or jazz. I had, of course, I knew that there was an interest in gospel music, especially guitar players, you know, and so on, because I was familiar with Blind Willie Johnson and so forth, you know. But anyway, at the time, I was taken by him, but I didn't really pursue it. I think I also recorded a little bit with Harry Oster. We met Butch Cage and Willie Thomas, you know. And anyway, so that stuck in my mind. And the next year, I believe in 61, I must have gone through there again. Maybe it was 62 when I finally met him. Apparently, I came through that same area, and I asked at one or two beer joints. I thought it was the same one that he had been in front of, or maybe it was the second one that I walked into, and asked the proprietor, you know, do you remember this man who was preaching the gospel? I didn't even know his name at the time. And then she told me that his name was Reverend Overstreet, and he was on his, he had left the area and had been on his way to California, but she heard that he may have stopped in Phoenix, Arizona. So on my way back to California that year, when I finally met him, it was this way. I looked for the black section, African-American section of Phoenix, which was south of the river, as I remember. And when people were still pumping gas for you, you know, you pulled up to a service station, and this young black man, he was filling my gas tank, and I asked him, have you by any chance seen a preacher who has four boys and who kind of sings? And he said, oh, yeah, he's got a church right around the corner. I mean, it was just absolutely incredible. So I went there, and indeed, it was a typical, very small storefront type church, you know, almost a shack-like building, as you can see in the photos, typical of many of the facilities, you know, that this kind of thing was happening in. And I guess I must have talked to him and asked him if I could come back and maybe record him and spend some time at his church with him. And he was very welcoming. And so that's what I did later that year, in the December of that year, whatever it was. I think, Tom, you remember, it was 62? Yeah, I think
it says the recordings were done in December 14th through 16th, 1962.
Correct. So you see, I was on my way back to Berkeley from a trip doing the. Yeah, I guess I was no longer. That's right. No, I was no longer teaching by that time. I think I started in 59 to 62. That's right. During that summer, I think, is when I was let go. I forgot. Anyway, this is all kind of. So I told him I would love to spend some time there. You know, I just was totally enamored by the whole thing. The small congregation, but very much like a holiness church, although the church was called Church of God in Christ, which is, of course, a major Black denomination, which is, however, musically very similar to the holiness churches, you know, like the later, our encounter with the Church of God, where the electric steel guitar was the main instrument. But and so I went back that December from Berkeley and drove down to Phoenix. And I think in the second photo, you will see my van. That's right. I already had a Volkswagen van by that time. And I'm not sure if it had a Ruby painted on it or not. If this was six, yeah, it probably did. Yeah, I probably possibly did.
You had a Volkswagen van that had the Arhuli guitar logo painted on it?
Yeah, correct. I think you can see it in some photos of me and Mance Lipscomb in Navasota, gotten off the thing. And I think there's that van in the background, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I actually slept in it during that trip when I went to Atlanta too. I remember finding an area of Atlanta, Georgia, where it seemed to be fairly quiet and sort of a richy area, and I parked it there and I slept there that night. Although the bugs were just incessant, they would always creep through the air holes, you know, and yeah, I had a sleeping bag with me, and, you know, because I didn't have much money to speak of. Somehow gas was fairly cheap, and I saved all my money I could during my year of teaching. Well, I think I got $7,000 per year in payment for my services. I forgot exactly. But anyway, so I think I stayed a week in Phoenix to make those recordings, because he was not that easy to catch. Maybe it was just a few days. I really don't know. You would have to look in the logbook. Maybe it'll tell you something more. But because he was usually kind of very short sermons. He was not like Reverend C.L. Franklin, you know, who could make a whole long sermon about, like, on one of his chess recordings that was done by Von Battle in Detroit, the recording. He did one on the subject, "You're nothing but a tadpole until you're born again." You know, on just that subject, he was able to do this. Reverend Overstreet was much, much shorter, and he would sort of blow his intensity very quickly, shall I put it that way. And but he was just an amazing guy who apparently had God tell him how to play the guitar and get a guitar and go out and preach the gospel. You'll probably find some of those interviews where he talks about it. Yeah, I do remember talking to him at length about it, you know, how he got to play the guitar. And I think he even talks to me about what kind of work he did before he became a minister. And, you know, this was all brand new to me. I was really not that familiar with the whole Black church syndrome and so forth, which is so different from anything I was used to. You know, in the village where I grew up, we had basically Protestants and Catholics, and that was it. And they were all very stoic and, you know, kind of totally very little music. They did whole organs. Yeah, anyway, I better not get off the track. And so when I met Bruce Bratton, I had met him already in the 50s. He was He was one of the people I got to know beside Justin Pope and of course Wayne Pope, and there's a whole bunch of people who were into skiffle music and jazz and so on, you see. And apparently Bruce Bratton had met this German filmmaker, Dietrich Wavzin, who had approached him whether he knew somebody in California that might take him around to do a jazz film. And my good friend Bruce Bratton, who still lives in Santa Cruz, he told him, yeah, you ought to get in touch with this guy, Chris Strachwitz. He's been down south for a couple of years now, and he might be able to help you. And so he did that. And when, of course, the Wavzins found out that I spoke German too, so that made the whole thing more possible. And so in 63, when they hired me to accompany them on their trip through what is now called as, I think we called the video Down Home Music 63, if I'm not mistaken, but he had originally produced little short films of what he called jazz, and one on gospel music, and one on whatever else there was, on blues. And that was my first experience really of assisting anyone who was making films. And of course, it wasn't just that. I was also responsible for doing the sound during pretty much the whole trip with the Wavzins. And so when we started out in Los Angeles, I mean, we actually started in the Bay Area, we filmed some things, and then we went to Los Angeles to do some kind of a seed thing. And I started driving towards Tucson. I told them we should really meet in Tucson, so that they were also very much intrigued by the whole black music scene, especially this very basic stuff. Oh yeah, in the Bay Area, we had already filmed His Highness Louis H. Narcisse of the Mount Zion Spiritual Temple, in Oakland. And he was totally enamored by that man, who I believe also belonged to the Church of God in Christ. I'm not sure, but it's called the Mount Zion Spiritual Temple. Anyway, this gets me into all of this. And so we started, as far as I'm concerned, on our lengthy trip across the South. Our first stop was really in Phoenix, and there they filmed Reverend Overstreet at his church with, some of the nice footage of them kind of doing the holiness dance, as I used to call them, when people get carried away and the spirit gets them, And then we also went to film him that Sunday when Reverend Overstreet told us that he was going to Tucson. He always goes on Sunday mornings to Tucson to preach in the streets. And there again, he went into the most downtrodden area of Tucson, which again, you will see the photos. Those are the photos I took of him and his four boys in Tucson, in sort of a slum area of that part of town. And anyway, so that is really what took me there. And
You got him booked at the Monterey Folk Festival.
oh yeah, you see, I had met what was his name? I had known Ralph Gleason, of course, who was very much involved with all that sort of thing. And there was a man who was in charge of that, and he was interested in presenting some elements of blues, and so forth, and related black music, And when I told him I'm bringing out this, that we could probably bring out Reverend Overstreet from Arizona, he got really excited about it. I wish I could think of his name right now, but he was in charge of the Monterey Jazz Festival in the beginnings. And they actually paid for him to come out here. And it was almost a tragedy, because they almost didn't make it, that is Reverend Overstreet and his boys, because they had no idea that Highway 1, which they decided was a nice way to drive, I mean, it was a way to get up to the Bay Area, to Monterey from Los Angeles, would take them forever, you know, instead of the more the larger Highway 101. And so they took Highway 1, which is the windiest road if you ever traveled on it, you know, from, especially from south, from Carmel southward, all the way to, oh God, anyway. And but they said the Lord sent them, and they made it possible, and they arrived just in time to make their appearance at the Monterey Jazz Festival. And I think right after that, we had them booked in the Cabal. And there again, Ralph Kahn, who was in charge, he was intrigued by the key that Reverend Overstreet played in. I think he told me, Chris, that's an F sharp or something he likes to play in. We asked him later on, how did he come to that? He said, that's the one that the Lord told me how to play in. You know, it was just absolutely amazing, kind of. And Ralph,
you know, how did he go over at the folk festival?
Well, I really don't remember. I think he went over quite well because nobody had ever heard anything quite like it, you know. And he did do a similar preaching, I think, like on one of the numbers on the recordings I made. He said, didn't he say, and we were asking for a blessing of Phoenix, and I'm blessing the people who are visiting me and something like that. You know, he would improvise things. I think they went over quite well, although I don't know if it got any reviews at all. I'm not sure.
I'm curious if you got a sense of how he felt about, first of all, you know, in Phoenix, here's this guy driving up in a Volkswagen van and wanting to record him. I mean, did you get a sense, did he think that was weird, or how did he feel about it? And then later you went to his home and all that.
Yeah, I think, you know, they all ascribe these things to a blessing. Because, you see, their whole purpose is really to bring the gospel to as many people as possible. And it didn't really matter if they're black and white. Like, even at his church there in Phoenix, one day I was there, and there was a white preacher, actually, in the church. They were perfectly accepting of him because he was very much in the similar type of vein, you know. He was also a holiness preacher. I think he absolutely, and people in general, were really nice to white people, especially since they knew about, you know, how even many of the smaller record companies were recording this music and were obviously, in a way, helping to publicize their religions and their music and singing and so forth. You know, that was already widely recorded and widely spread. Like, I'll never forget when the Vavtsins asked Reverend Overstreet, you know, what he would like for his participation. You know, they paid him something, and then he was totally enamored by their 45 player that they had in their Mercedes. And so they were happy to give that to him. Although I have a feeling that never really worked, because, you know, if you're in a bouncy car, a 45 is, and that was before cassettes were invented. And it was a very brief, I think, existence of 45 players in cars. But you see, gospel music had been recorded widely ever since the 20s, along with other black music, you know. And I think they were aware of the fact that this is one way to reach a larger audience, you know.
So let me ask you about these specific pictures. There's the one that he is in front of the church, I guess. That's his church that he's standing in front of,
yes,
with the four,
yes,
boys.
Yes.
And then the drum that's directly in front of him, did he play that with a foot pedal?
Yes, he played that with his foot pedal, correct. And of course, the young boys played all the various rhythm instruments, you know, a washboard and a tambourine and I forgot what else. He was kind of a one-man band, you know. And I think he started off, yeah, that's right, I interviewed him about that. He started off in singing with quartets, but he said he could never depend on the other members of the quartet who were just out to have a good time, you know. And so he created his family, and the Lord blessed him with having four boys who, that's exactly what he told me, you know, that he had these boys who started singing with him. It's just really, really remarkable, the whole thing. Yeah.
And then the later pictures where he's out in the street, was that then in Tucson?
Yes, that was in Tucson. Mm-hmm. He apparently went down there every Sunday. But he did all the rest of the time. They had small services on weekdays, even in the evenings, because almost all his, much of his, you will see the audience is not big in his church, but they actually have a choir there where the boys join in, and there's a choir master in front. You see him in some of the pictures. And, you know, it's very serious. I think it's, yeah, and also from him I learned, I asked him where he learned all his songs, and I believe they went to there's an annual, you know, convention of the Church of God in Christ in, I believe, in Memphis or in Nashville. I think it was in Memphis. And he told me that that's where they learn all their songs from each other.
Anything else that comes to mind? Or
it was just one of those things where, I mean, some people will say it was Lady Luck who showed me that way. Some people say, well, it's, you have an amazing angel who watches over you and guides you in the right direction, you know. I just, I don't know what to say about all that, but somehow I met all these people by coincidence or by having known somebody else who took me there, you know, and people were all so forthcoming, and, you know, I don't think you can ever do anything quite like that again, although who knows, you know, and American culture was so amazingly diverse. Anyway, I just loved every minute of it, and meeting these people, you know, but it's only in my older days now that I realize that this vernacular music simply never sits still for 1 minute. You know, it constantly evolves. But that's why I was so amazed at how much tradition was carried on, you know, especially during those early days. And even before records, of course, records perpetuated certain sounds, you know, because they all figured, well, if this guy makes a hit, that's, I better sound like that, you know. And that, unfortunately, has carried totally to the present. It's a never-changing world.
Right.